days of Indian classical music and dance on Saturday, July 27th and Sunday, July 28th at the Soka University Performing Arts Center in Aliso Viejo, California. Artists from around the world unite to create an unforgettable cultural experience. Dive into a multitude of workshops from Indian rhythm on Western drums to playing raga music on the guitar. For more information and tickets, visit festivaloftabla.com and kpfk.org.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and on the web at kpfk.org.
Afternoon, friends. This is Maria Hall welcoming you to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. My wonderful co-host Jim Lafferty is still out traveling, but he'll be back with us again in just a few more weeks. And in the meantime, we've got a great show lined up for you today. First, I'll be joined by Fran Campbell, one of the lead lawyers who represented hundreds of Barrington Plaza tenants in their historic court win against their corporate landlord. Then we'll turn to the subject of immigration. We'll be joined by immigration lawyer Tatiana Barraza and workers' rights attorney Helen Yu about some of the legal protections for non-citizens in their workplace. But first, of course, don't forget it's summer fun drive here on KPFK. So please take 30 seconds right now to say thank you by making a donation at kpfk.org. We all need to pitch in to help KPFK stay free, independent, and strong. And at the very end of the hour, I do have a special surprise guest coming on to sort of help me talk about how great KPFK is. So stay tuned for that as well. All right, so let's just keep it moving forward onto our first segment. Tenant and tenant advocates are still pinching themselves to make sure they didn't dream it. The fabulous court decision 2 weeks ago that stopped corporate landlord Douglas Emmett in its tracks from evicting hundreds of tenants from their rent-controlled homes at Barrington Plaza. Douglas Emmett, well, it's a corporate real estate company, and it just so happened they contributed $566,000 to the 2022 campaign of Tracy Park, who's now the council member for that very district. So it may not surprise you to find out that the city of LA refused to take action to stop Douglas Emmett from executing its mass eviction plan. But luckily, tenants found power elsewhere, in themselves, in each other, and as we'll discuss here, from fabulous legal counsel. I'm so happy to introduce you today to our guest, attorney Fran Campbell. If you've seen news coverage of the court case, you've probably seen Fran with her blonde bob and big oversized glasses and authoritative presence. Fran is a partner in the firm Campbell & Farahani LLP in Sherman Oaks and has practiced civil rights law, mostly housing rights law, for, about a little over 20 years now. Fran is a friend to all of us in the housing rights movement, and the Barrington Plaza tenants were certainly fortunate to have her as their lawyer. Fran Campbell, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thank you, Maria. I'm so pleased to be here.
Well, Fran, can you start us off by giving us a little of the backstory of the Barrington Plaza property? How old is it? When was it built? Where is it located for people who may not be familiar with LA? And how big is it?
Well, Barrington Plaza is a group of three apartment towers, and they're in the Sawtelle district of Los Angeles. And if you don't know where that is, it's just south of Brentwood. So it's a pretty fab area of town to live in. It's got 712 units in these three towers. And because the building was built in 1961, all of these units are rent stabilized. So there's a couple of exemptions because it was around when 1978 came around and the Los Angeles Rent Stabilization Ordinance was passed. So there's some units that have luxury exemptions, but the vast majority of the units are rent stabilized there.
Okay. So tell us a little more about Douglas Emmett, that corporate landlord who I referred to in the introduction, who owns Barrington Plaza.
Douglas Emmett is a nationally traded real estate investment trust. Okay, so publicly traded, I should say. They own a lot of luxury apartment buildings and a lot of offices, I think even more offices. They used to be my landlord when my office was in Sherman Oaks. Now we live in a we live. We work at Agora Hills, so they're no longer our landlords, but they're just a very big landlord in Southern California.
As a matter of fact, that reminded me in my one of my old offices, they were my landlord too. Okay, so now, yes, more interesting. Who are the tenants of Barrington Plaza? And I know that's a very broad question, but what are kind of the demographics? What are their age ranges? What are their socioeconomic and cultural backgrounds? Are they all rich? Because, man, that is a great part of town to live in.
Well, I don't think they're all rich. Like most tenants, it's just there's a large range of socioeconomic situations. Some are professional, some are not professional, some are unemployed. As far as who lives there, their socioeconomic background, there's all kinds. I mean, there's some immigrants, there's some non-immigrants. I mean, it's when you have a group of hundreds and hundreds of tenants, you have everyone, right? Now, some people have been there a very long time, but actually not that many. And I'm talking about now before the eviction notices went out. At the moment, of the 712 units in the Barrington Plaza, about 100 units remain occupied. So
Wow.
those are the people who are still there. So that means about 550 units were vacated. Wait, let me make sure I'm doing my math correctly. No, it means about 450 units were vacated after the Ellis Act eviction notices were served.
Wow. Okay, so hold that thought. Let's back up a little bit. And before we talk about, because I do want to talk about that, about people who kind of left, because it would be terrifying to get this eviction notice. But let's talk about those eviction notices. I understand Douglas Emmett served notices to hundreds of tenants, and with rent-controlled tenancies. What was their excuse? What was their reason? And when did that happen?
It happened on May 8th, 2023. And the supposed grounds for the eviction was that they were removing all these units permanently from the rental housing market. Interestingly, on the same day, they issued a press release that said that they were removing the units from the market to give them the opportunity, and for the radio listeners, I'm using air quotes, to install sprinklers in all of the units. So these two things don't really go together. I know you know, but maybe your listeners don't know that the Ellis Act is a state law that was passed in the mid-80s to allow landlords, typically smaller mom-and-pop landlords, to stop being landlords, to go out of the rental business. Prior to the Ellis Act being passed, there was a court decision called Nash versus City of Santa Monica. And Mr. Nash, unbelievably, a 19-year-old who owned an apartment building, did not like his tenants. He said they were ungrateful. It was nothing. Listen, he didn't even split hairs. He said, I don't like them. I hate them. I hate them so much. I don't want to be a landlord anymore. And I just want to demolish this place. And so hold the land for an investment for its land value. And the city of Santa Monica said to Mr. Nash, no, we're not going to let you do that because under our regs, you're still making enough money here. So we're not going to let you demolish the building with these rent controlled units. And Mr. Nash sued the city of Santa Monica and he was mad about that. And the Superior Court agreed with Mr. Nash and says, well, isn't this sort of like slavery that Santa Monica is forcing you to be a landlord? And the Court of Appeal agreed with the Superior Court there. And then the California Supreme Court reversed the Court of Appeal, says, well, okay, we get it. Maybe it's sort of like slavery, but not so much like slavery, because you could, you're making a profit and you could just sell this place. So yay for City of Santa Monica, but the real estate concerns as a whole in the state of California took note of this. And that's why a movement was started to pass what became the Ellis Act, which was to say that cities, you can't force people to remain landlords if what they really want to do is stop being landlords. And that's what all Mr. Nash wanted to do, get rid of his ungrateful tenants and stop being a landlord. And the City of Santa Monica was wrong to help him. So that's the new law that was passed. So it seems strange to move from that situation to 2024, when we're talking about a publicly traded real estate investment trust saying, we want to go out of business under the Ellis Act and stop being landlords. Of course, they do not. That is not in their business plan. That is their job. They're not going out of business. And so that's what was strange about Douglas Emmett serving these notices on the Barrington Plaza tenants. On the one hand, they say, you're being evicted under Los Angeles Rent Stabilization Ordinance, which requires landlords to be removing the units permanently from the rental market. And on the other hand, they're saying, we're putting in sprinklers.
Right.
To sprinkle whom? Right? So that was the question.
Right. And that's because you were saying under city law, it was, you know, why did they choose this Ellis Act?
Because they had no other grounds. Under city law, there's only certain grounds you can evict people if they don't pay their rent, if they violate their lease. Interestingly, one reason you can evict people in the city of Los Angeles is if the government has issued an order saying you must eliminate this unit or otherwise vacate, you must get rid of your tenants in order to comply with our order to whatever, demolish a unit or something. So Douglas Emmett actually spent years going around to the city council members asking them to pass a law that would allow the fire department to issue it an order to comply so it could put in sprinklers.
Whoa.
And that would have allowed them to evict everyone permanently with no right of return. And when that didn't work out for them, after about 2.5-3 years of effort, they happened upon a law firm that had Ellis Act expertise, they said, and this law firm advised them that they could go out of business under the Ellis Act temporarily. I don't know why, but that was apparently the legal advice according to the testimony in court.
Wow. I love hearing that backstory. Well, now let's go back and talk about the tenants who were, you know, that moment when they received those notices. What were those tenants, you know, from your experience, what were they feeling? You know, did they feel like, oh, we're going to fight this, this is BS? Or did they think, wow, you know, the courts might agree with them?
Well, my firm didn't get hired right away. So I didn't know any of these tenants or anything about this really when it happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I could tell you from decades of doing eviction defense work, as well as suing landlords for doing bad things to people. When people get eviction notices, they get really worried and a little bit over worried, because most people don't know that evictions aren't like they used to be, that it's not going on your record. You don't have a big scarlet letter on your rental history. Most unlawful detainers now, well, they're all confidential when they're filed, and they only become unconfidential if the landlord wins within 60 days. But people don't generally know this. They think, I'll never be able to rent again. And they are very, very worried. And you can reassure them 10, 20 times that when this eviction notice expires, that does not mean that, no, here comes the sheriff on your door the next day, that there still has to be a legal process. They're just worried that something is going to happen when that eviction notice expires. And it really is irrational fear. But that irrational fear caused them so much anxiety and worry that many people just vacate because they don't want to face the consequences they imagine. So just the service of eviction notices, I hate to say it out loud, but a powerful tool for landlords to just worry people out of their tenancies. Right. I imagine that is what was going on May 8th when everyone received an eviction notice on their door. Imagine what that must be like to be in a building with 200, 300 units and every single one of your neighbors is getting evicted on the same day.
And then how much notice did they have to move out before the landlord had threatened to initiate court action?
Well, under the Ellis Act, you have 120 days. So it's more than the normal eviction notice. So they all had 120 days to worry. And then if you're a senior or you're disabled, you can invoke your right to an entire year to leave. So many people receiving this information from the housing department did tell the landlord, Douglas Emmett, we're going to stay for the entire year. But that wasn't everyone in the building, of course. I mean, I think there were about, I pulled up the form to be sure here, 102, which were initially identified as seniors or disabled, at least by the landlord, who would have had that time to stay. And then there are a few others who maybe had disabilities who would invoke their right to stay. But, you know, for example, their disability wasn't known to the landlord. So I'm going to ask you to ask me another question.
Yeah. So I guess that brings us up to the time then that your firm, Campbell and Farahani, became involved. And was that, so some people it had only the 120 days. Did you get involved at that time or was it later? And then I would really love for you to walk through the legal and organizing strategies that led to the court victory.
Well, I'll start with the reason we became involved in the first place was because of an organizer, Larry Gross with the Coalition for Economic Survival, who, you know, recognized that this was not a correct use of the Ellis Act, since he's been involved in the passage of numerous rent stabilization ordinances. And he happened to discuss it with me because I volunteer for the CES clinic every Saturday. So we talk frequently. And he told me what was going on. And I said, that's not an Ellis. And he goes, I know. And from that, he put us together, the tenants in our firm. And we got retained, I think it was early June, because we filed the complaint on June 12th. So that's what we decided to do. He put it together with us, and we filed a declaratory relief action, just seeking a declaration from the judge that says, effectively, these notices are no good. They will not support a judgment for eviction.
Can you explain that part? Because even when I, you know, as a housing lawyer myself, I was trying to find information among the media out there about it. It said like a trial, or it said, you know, I wasn't quite sure what legal strategy you had used. So can you explain what that means, you know, asking the court for declaratory relief and what it gave you, what it gave you?
Yes. So declaratory relief action is an action where two people have two different views of what should happen based on a document or based on a law or of their rights, of their obligations. And when that impasse is there, one of the other side can file a lawsuit in court to have a judge, you know, tell people, no, you, based on this piece of paper, for example, you have to do X or Y or Z. And so that's what we did. We filed a lawsuit asking the court or a judge to declare that the eviction notices would not support an eviction judgment under Los Angeles law. Because under Los Angeles law, they were going to have to prove that they intended in good faith to remove all these rental units from the rental market permanently. And the documents they had filed in the planning department showed that they were remodeling and upgrading this unit. Their own press release said that they were putting in sprinklers. And you don't put in sprinklers when you're going out of business because there's no point to that. And so we felt pretty confident that we could, you know, at some point get a declaratory judgment that the eviction notices were effectively no good. And so far, we did get that, but a tentative decision, which I believe will be, you know, very close to a final decision. Judge Ford agreed with us.
Excellent. Well, for those just tuning in, you're listening to Pacifica's KPFK 90.7 FM. This is the Lawyers Guild Show, and I'm your co-host, Maria Hall. I'm speaking with the wonderful attorney, Fran Campbell, about the recent victory, or tentative victory, but pretty sure, we don't want to jinx it, but 99.9% sure that it'll be a permanent victory for tenants at Barrington Plaza. And just a quick reminder, it is KPFK's fund drive time. So please, you can just run on over to kpfk.org. It'll take you 30 seconds. Make your quick donation, whatever you can afford. And every dollar counts, truly. Okay, so I wanted to ask a follow-up question to Fran Campbell. So was there testimony taken? I think you had just alluded to some testimony. Can you tell us about that? Because I couldn't find anything in the media about that. And I was dying to know what they actually claimed, you know, who testified.
Well, Jordan Kaplan testified, who's the, you know, president, CEO, head honcho of Douglas Emmett. Wow. His general counsel, Michelle Aronson, testified. And they had a few other people who testified, a gentleman who was, you know, I hate to say their titles because they're often titles of many different entities, but I believe he was one of the head honchos of Douglas Emmett Builders testified. And then they had a couple of other witnesses, not many. I think that they had five or six witnesses in all. And the tenants really had none. And the reason they had none was because this was a lawsuit about Douglas Emmett's or Barrington Pacific's intent to remove the units permanently from the rental market. And we were able to prove the case through their papers, through the documents we received in discovery, which showed throughout the, for years before and projected after the eviction notices that they were not going out of the rental business. So, when the case passed to the tenants to put on their case, they decided to just rest because we had everything in through them. And there was really nothing, no one to call, you know, to talk about their intent. They were forthcoming about the fact that they intended to remodel and re-rent these units, but their position was that the Ellis Act allows landlords to temporarily remove units from the market so that they could renovate and remodel. And even in closing argument, the judge asked them, even if it's for 30 days, 31 days, they said yes. He said, even if it's for 30 minutes, they said yes. So the weight of the evidence does show that they intended to remodel. It's going to be substantial remodel and renovation. It's going to take a long time. Nevertheless, it is a remodel and renovate job. So what they were required to do was to remodel and renovate, they needed to enter into a tenant habitability plan, because when you're doing major renovations of a rent-stabilized unit, it's going to take over 30 days or require new systems to be put in place. Then the city doesn't clear your permit until they know that your tenants who are occupying now are going to be relocated to another place and then move back. That's what was supposed to happen.
Right. I was going to ask that. I was going to say it's not like, you know, landlords certainly couldn't just be out of luck if they need to do some improvements, right?
I mean, no, absolutely not. There is a very clear path. there's the permitting process, and the way it's supposed to work is if there's an occupied unit, there's supposed to be a tenant habitability plan to make sure the tenants aren't forcibly displaced because the landlord wants to renovate.
Right. and presumably increase the rent way above the rent stabilized unit.
Well, the interesting thing is, if they're forcibly displaced, of course, then they can raise the rent to market. The tenant habitability program exists so tenants in rent stabilized units aren't forcibly displaced and maintain their right to the lower rents that they have through their long-term tenancies in rent controlled units.
Mm-hmm. So what do you foresee as, and I can't believe how fast time is going, it always does, but what do you foresee their next moves are? Have they indicated that, you know, they're now just going to turn around and do it another way, or are they going to do it the right way this time?
Well, as you might imagine, you're hardly the first person to ask me to speculate about what Douglas Emmett and their lawyers have planned. I've been asked that question maybe 100 times. However, it would be rank speculation for me to say what they plan to do now. Friday is a deadline for people to file objections to the tentative statement of decision. Oh. They may object to it. And they have that right. What they're supposed to do is object to omissions or ambiguities in the statement of decision. But often people disappointed by a bench trial will just object to the outcome for various reasons. So we'll wait and see what happens there. Once Judge Ford rules on those objections, then the statement of decision becomes final. It may be changed slightly, or it might actually could be changed entirely, but that's less likely. Statements of decision don't usually change entirely because of objections. So we'll see what happens. But what they're going to do legally and factually now, I cannot begin to imagine. That's not true. I just lied. I have imagined over and over again, but it's worthless imagining to share with your listeners.
Right. it's certainly going to be part of our LA history, because that took some guts there of them to just try to rewrite the law on their own unilaterally.
It really is rewriting the law. And there's no case that even suggests that this is permissible under the Ellis Act. And the entire legislative history, which, by the way, everyone had, doesn't suggest that Ellising a building can ever be temporary. So it was a very novel theory of why they were allowed to evict people.
Well, I would like to conclude with a question that is, it's one that I ask other attorneys who I love. And that is, how do you keep going on? Because there are, you know, we're celebrating this win because we don't always get wins on this side of, you know, fighting power and corporations with a ton of money. So what kind of keeps you going in this? What kind of inspiration can you give to the rest of us?
Well, isn't that fight fun though? I mean, I don't know. That's kind of what keeps me going. You know, I used to say a million years ago, and I probably even said to you when we were officing together, that it's a joy to represent, you know, the 92-year-old monolingual Spanish speaking tenant who doesn't even know how to read or write and has, you know, all kinds of disabilities. It's a pleasure to represent that person, not only because it's the right thing to do, a good thing to do, but because the landlord never sees it coming when that person has a lawyer behind them. And that's just a delicious feeling to represent people who really appear to the world to not have any power or agency, and to be able to come in and stop an abusive act that someone can commit just because they have the money and resources to do it. So I don't know. That's what keeps me going. The other thing that keeps me going is it's a lot of fun to push the law around. You know, if you can, you do work that actually makes a law more clear, changes the law, that's satisfying. right? You could say, you could point out where the law is missing something or needs to be fixed in some way. If there's a question that hasn't been answered, it keeps coming up. The Court of Appeal will answer if you could just bring it to it with the right vehicle. And then often they publish their decisions. And then you can really feel like, wow, I participated in, you know, clarifying the law. And that's historical, right? It will be in the law books that still exist in physical form. Who knows for how much longer.
AI will bring it up.
Well, hopefully AI will bring it up. AI might make up holdings.
We'll do that on another show. Yeah.
But so those are the two. I mean, that's how I keep going. I mean, it's just fun. You know, I can't even imagine retiring, right? Because I was saying to someone the other day, you know, you could be sitting in the retirement home, you know, sipping a margarita or whatever under an umbrella, and someone could come up and say, "Do you hear what happened to Judith?" You might go, "No, what happened to Judas?" "Oh, she got this notice." And then wouldn't you, Maria Hall, with your law license, go, "Oh, no, that's not going to happen to Judas." Well, that's a lot of fun, right? To be able to, like, actually, you know, stop a bad act in progress. So I don't see retiring from this gig. It is a grind.
Yeah.
But there's still a lot of fun parts about it.
Well, that is a great way to end the show. Unfortunately, it's already that time. But tell us how people can learn more about, you know, the tenants, different tenants associations out there, maybe Coalition for Economic Survival, and of course, your firm.
Well, anyone who lives or used to live at Barrington Plaza should always be in touch with the Barrington Plaza Tenant Association. They are still there representing all the tenants still in place and the displaced tenants. Coalition for Economic Survival has a legal clinic every Saturday, and people can sign up for that and meet one-on-one with an attorney, maybe me, maybe another fine attorney. And people can contact my firm, really just the best way, Google Campbell and Farahani, Farahani, and you can certainly contact us too.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Fran Campbell. It is really wonderful to see you here on Zoom and for listeners to hear your voice. Congratulations again on amazing work. And I look forward to seeing you in the future. Hopefully,
I look forward to seeing you again soon, Maria Hall. Thank you for having me on.
All right. Okay. Well, that was attorney Fran Campbell talking about the Barrington Plaza victory. If you're just tuning in, this is KPFK 90.7 FM. Normally we would take a short station ID break, but instead of doing that, I'm going to ask you to take these 30 seconds to make your donation to kpfk@kpfk.org, or just call us at 818-985-5735. And, you know, maybe you're somebody who is thinking, wow, gee, maybe I could be a lawyer. You know, you hear Fran talk about it, and that's so inspiring. And, you know, it was actually in 1999, before I even started law school, that I was listening to Democracy Now! And heard a story about women in prison who were dying of cancer because the prison wasn't treating it. And I heard lawyers on there who were changing the law and got the prison to give them the treatment. And at that moment, I thought, wow, lawyers can really have a life and death impact. They can make change for the better. And it was then that I thought, wow, gee, maybe I should look into going to law school, which I'd never thought before. So I do credit KPFK for that big aha moment in my own life. And maybe you also have had one of those moments, or one of those moments will soon to hit you, soon to be for you as well. So please give at kpfk.org. Let's keep it going strong and proud and free. Okay, so now that, oh yes, and Fran just sent me a chat note that yes, and we need more housing lawyers. So please, 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 any of the LA law schools, you know, they, most of them have, you know, housing clinics. We can get you volunteering right away. We will set you up. You will never be unemployed. I promise you that if you do housing law. All right. So back to the show. Now we're going to turn to the subject of immigration, which has been taking center stage as the presidential election heats up. Unfortunately, most discussions are fueled by emotion and sound bites, and few are actually informed by those who are most impacted by what the law is, you know, namely non-citizens themselves and their family members, and of course, their legal advocates. So today, those of us armchair philosophers on the immigration front are going to sit back and let two attorneys who are in the trenches with their clients navigating not only the complex immigration laws, but also who are fighting for their legal rights in other contexts as they are here living and surviving and trying to make a living in the United States. First, we have Tatiana Barraza. She's a Spanish-speaking immigration attorney. Her firm is called Law Office of Tatiana Barraza, and she assists clients all over LA and Orange County. She's a native Spanish speaker and represents clients in family, petitions, and humanitarian contexts. And we have Helen Yu. Helen also owns her own firm, Law Office of Helen Yu. And Helen represents workers against their employers in discrimination, harassment, and retaliation matters, as well as other labor disputes, including, as you'll hear, wage and hour violations. And Helen also often ends up representing and fighting for the rights of non-citizens in their jobs. So full disclosure, both Tatiana and Helen are current participants in the Los Angeles Incubator Consortium, which is a program that supports new solo community lawyers, which I also happen to direct. So there's that. Anyway, welcome to the show, Tatiana and Helen.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Yes. Hello. I echo the same sentiment.
Wonderful. Well, let's start off with a question for Tatiana. Before we delve into protecting non-citizens at work, which I really do want to focus in on, first, can you explain some of the brand new immigration policies that were announced last week by the White House, which it claims will keep families together? What's that all about?
Sure. Yes. So just recently, President Biden announced a new plan, which would potentially allow a significant number of non-citizens who are married to U.S. citizens to remain in the U.S. for a specified amount of time to obtain work authorization and potentially also allow them to seek permanent resident status while inside the United States. So to give some context, generally, people who are neither inspected nor admitted nor paroled into the United States are not eligible to apply for permanent residency inside of the United States. Instead, they must undergo through a process called consular processing that requires them to depart the United States, attend an interview at a consulate before re-entering. Departing triggers a bar. And then to overcome this bar, they must seek a waiver. Now, the issue there is that not everyone qualifies for this waiver, and the waivers are currently taking a really long time to adjudicate. So here's where the new program comes in. Individuals who are paroled would potentially satisfy this inspected or paroled requirement, which in turn would render them eligible to apply for permanent resident status inside the United States without having to depart the country.
Wow. Yes, that definitely sounds like a better option. Okay, so now let's turn to the workers' rights. Last year, I think it was, the Department of Homeland Security announced a new process that they said is designed to protect non-citizens who work for employers that are being investigated for labor violations. So Tatiana, can you give us a little more background and detail about that program and its purpose? And then I'll turn it over to Helen Yu to talk about some of the workers' rights.
Sure. So this program is known as labor-based deferred action. It's a relatively new program that allows individuals who have been victims or witnesses of labor violations to obtain temporary protection, also to obtain work authorization for a period of 2 years and a social security number. And really the purpose behind this program is to allow undocumented workers to participate and to cooperate in an ongoing labor investigation who would otherwise be reluctant to do so due to a fear of retaliation, particularly in immigration-related retaliation.
And Helen, you, as a labor lawyer, what are some of the special challenges that undocumented workers face here in Southern California specifically? And can you give us some examples of the violations that you've seen in your cases and what workers should be kind of on the lookout for? Because maybe they didn't even know it was illegal.
Yeah, definitely. I'm sure this is nothing new, but there is rampant wage theft in Southern California, which unfortunately disproportionately affects some of our most vulnerable communities. Because of what Tatiana was talking about, this fear of retaliation. We heard several years ago there were discussion of workplace raids by ICE. And that is something that may embolden employers to essentially skirt paying their employees all wages owed, which includes not paying the appropriate rate for overtime, not paying the appropriate wage for double time, if paying double time at all, not permitting legally compliant meal and rest breaks. And there are many things that we can dive into for that. But some of the things practitioners and employees themselves, workers themselves, can be on the lookout for, rather than these more egregious, well-talked about issues, are illegal releases in wage statements. So for example, if there is a line in your pay stub that says, by signing this document, by signing this pay stub, you are acknowledging that all hours are correct, the pay is correct, and you waive any rights to enforce based on this pay period. That is an illegal release. That is something that definitely people to this day try and sneak in there to in some belief that they can shield themselves from some type of liability. There are many others, but I want to be mindful of our time, because I also wanted to mention, again, as I'm sure is not new for our listeners, is there are issues with discrimination, harassment, and gender and sex harassment has really made the news in the last couple of years. But some people would be surprised at how overt race discrimination can still look, how overt disability discrimination looks. Also, there are issues, not just in other places in the country, but also with in Southern California, as to the rights of trans people and gender nonconforming people in the workplace. And so these are all issues that employees and their advocates should be on the lookout for, particularly as they may be potential avenues for deferred action, as we'll talk about.
Yes, perfect segue. Let's turn back to Tatiana to explain some of the more nuanced parts about, you know, how people can use that process. But then also maybe some risks of putting themselves out there like that, and then we'll follow that with some other pathways that are also available and some other protections. But let's focus in on this deferred action for the labor violations.
Sure. Yes. So there are a number of considerations to keep in mind when determining whether to apply or not. First off, I think it's important to understand that this program does not offer a path towards permanent resident status, let alone citizenship. It also does not allow one to leave the country and then re-enter. It's also important to note that the future of the program is rather uncertain. There really is no guarantee that the applicant will be able to renew his or her deferred action or his or her work authorization after that initial 2-year period. And then ultimately, I think what's interesting here is that this really is a discretionary grant, which means that It comes down to a balancing of equities, positive versus negative. So the adjudicating body, in this case DHS, will weigh positive equities against negative equities and ultimately determine whether or not to grant deferred action. So positive equities could be community ties. It could be having U.S. citizen or permanent resident relatives. On the other hand, negative equities could be, you know, having a criminal history, including multiple convictions, recent convictions, or unfavorable immigration history. So overall, I do think that the decision to apply for this program really is case by case. It's really specific. And an attorney should present all risks and advantages to the client if need be, conduct Freedom of Information Acts, conduct background checks, balance these equities, consider the need for work authorization for each particular individual. And ultimately, it should be up to the non-citizen to determine whether or not it makes sense in his or her specific case.
Okay, well, now is the question that I'm looking forward to the most. And let's start with Helen, but then I'll ask Tatiana the same question. Besides the deferred action for the labor violations, what are some of the other legal protections for non-citizens in the workplace?
Yeah, before we jump into that, I wanted to also mention that's what is extremely important for applying for this type of deferred action. An applicant must have what's called a statement of interest from a labor agency, from a state or federal labor agency. That is a prerequisite for this type of application, basically stating that the state stating that the labor agency has an interest in these non-citizens, their continued presence for their investigation into these labor violations. There are many resources with other nonprofits who give very in-depth presentations as to how to apply. So please check those out for a step-by-step. But moving on to other types of relief, I'll say it's very important to note that the labor commissioner in California, they will enforce the labor laws regardless of immigration status. So non-citizens are entitled to their day's wage, just as much as anyone else is. They do not ask for that type of information if you were to make a wage complaint or if you were to file a lawsuit based on violations of the labor code.
And does that go for, you know, most constitutional law and most civil rights?
Well, that's a good question. I'm thinking of, there are some SCOTUS opinions that I think it had
Supreme
to
Court,
do.
Supreme Court of the United States.
Yes. I think it was Justice Brennan who had some interesting things to say a few years ago about this. I'll say in California, with our Department of Fair Employment and Housing, now known as the Civil Rights Department, California Civil Rights Department, they offer broader protections in employment than the federal counterparts, which includes discrimination on the basis of immigration status. That could be non-citizen, that could be a permanent resident non-citizen, and so on and so forth. So there are also reliefs in employment it might not be immigration status. I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the top, but it's definitely for nationality. And so you still have to be a bit careful. There's evidentiary rules that say that you cannot be compelled to disclose this type of immigration information, as well as if it gets to a trial, there might be a Fifth Amendment right to not self-incriminate. So these are things that definitely need to be considered in approaching these types of immigration actions, particularly where the person or person's non-citizen status is at the crux of the violations.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's turn that same question over to Tatiana. What other legal protections are there if people feel a little skittish about using the deferred action, or they're somehow not able to? What are some of the other avenues for people who are they're having their rights not respected at their workplace?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Within the immigration context, so I did mention that labor-based deferred action does not offer a path towards residency, but an individual may also be able or may also be eligible for something like a U visa or a T visa that does offer eventually a path towards permanent residency. So a U visa is granted to individuals who have been victims of qualifying crimes. And a T visa is for individuals who have been victims of trafficking in persons, whether that be sexual trafficking or labor trafficking. So there really is an intersection here, particularly in the realm of a T visa and a labor-based deferred action. So I definitely recommend looking into the requirements for these other forms of relief, as one may be eligible to pursue more than just labor-based deferred action.
Wonderful. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time already. I can't believe how fast the time goes, but you're both amazing. And please let listeners know how they can find out more about immigration rights. You'd mentioned some organizations, and then also where they can learn how to learn more about you. Let's start with Helen.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find more information through, I'm going to call out the National Day Labor Organizing Network, or NDLON. They have done some great work as to this program, getting the word out and helping people apply for deferred action. They're doing amazing work. You can find me normally at the law library, LA Law Library, I'm always around. That's where I don't have a website right now, so that's why I can't tell anyone to visit my website, but I'm around.
Yes. And Tatiana?
Sure. In addition, I say you can always visit DHS. The DHS website. So DHS.gov, you'll see a number of fact sheets. You will see eligibility requirements for nearly any type of immigration relief out there that you may be interested in learning more about. As for me, I will not be at the LA Law Library, but my website is TatianaBarraza.com, and you can reach me by email, tb@TatianaBarraza.com.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much to our guests today, attorneys Tatiana Barraza and Helen Yu. And we'll definitely be having you on because we're going to have a lot of immigration updates, I'm sure, as we near this election and who knows what comes next. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Okay. Now I'm very excited to introduce a surprise special guest. We have KPFK's general manager, Michael Novak. Woohoo! Michael was formerly chair of the local station board and is a retired public school teacher and was a shop steward for UTLA, a movement journalist and a published author, editor of Turning the Tide, and on the staff of ChangeLinks. Michael Novak, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Hi, thank you, Maria. I hope I'm audible. Yes. Yeah, that was another great program. I want to point out to listeners that today is the International Day in Support of Victims of Torture, declared by the United Nations. It's the anniversary of the UN Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment. And I know that some of the lawyers involved with the Lawyers Guild program and with the National Lawyers Guild have been involved with defending victims of torture at Guantanamo, opposing the use of torture inside U.S. prisons. And, to remind our listeners that this program only comes to you through your own support for KPFK. And you know, I get every day a dozen emails, and I get, you know, direct mail appeals, my P.O. box constantly for a lot of different causes. And the one donation you can make that will affect all those things is a donation to KPFK, and that we really do need it. I want to emphasize to people, you know, people sometimes think that we cry wolf or we're pleading poverty, but the fact is that we exist on a very, very tight shoestring budget. I'm not being paid to be a general manager. Our program director, Marlee DeBond, is unpaid. Our operations manager is unpaid. We have a small unionized staff that is paid, but most of the money that comes in to support the station goes to cover the nuts and bolts, the electricity, the hardware, the rent, now that we have to pay for our new facility. And people need to take seriously the possibility that we will go out of business. I know that you might have had some involvement with, for example, the People's College of Law, which was a project here in Los Angeles of the Lawyers Guild and of other progressive lawyers. And this program itself, the Lawyers Guild, people associate sometimes with the NLG, but actually it originated as a joint project of the National Lawyers Guild, the National Conference of Black Lawyers, I think the Asian Pacific Islander Legal Center, the MALDEF. And, you know, that kind of coalition is necessary to keep this station afloat. People's College of Law is no more. It does not exist. There were problems with the, I guess the Bar Association, there were some internal conflicts, et cetera, et cetera. But that's a great loss to the movement. And I'm pleased that you're doing that incubator. That's terrific. But, you know, it reflects the fact that all these institutions that are created by grassroots community organizations are at risk. And KPFK, frankly, is at risk unless we can increase the funding that we receive and rebuild our membership. Maybe three or four years ago, prior to the pandemic, we had about twice as many members as we have now. There was a precipitous decline in 2021. And we're trying to rebuild that this year. And we really need everybody who is currently listening to subscribe. 818-985-5735. You've heard the number a thousand times, but I'll repeat it again. 818-985-KPFK. Press option 2 for the pledge line, or go to the website kpfk.org. Either way, you can become a sustaining member. There are some thank you gifts available, but what we're emphasizing is the value of the programming and the values that the programming represents. And if you share those values and you appreciate the value of what you just heard on this program, a lot of really vital information of great use to people facing some of the situations that were being discussed in terms of evictions and tenants' rights, in terms of migrant rights and deferred action. Deferred action means that at some point the government is going to act against them, and they're just putting it off. So if you want to change those terms, we need to support a station like KPFK. And, you know, I heard you say earlier, Maria, about your own impact, and I'm somebody as well. I grew up listening to WBAI in New York, which is a Pacific affiliate. And, you know, I've been involved with KPFA for a period when I lived in the Bay Area, and I've been down here since 82. Mm-hmm. And without KPFK and without the other Pacifica stations, the world would be a much harsher place.
Mm-hmm. I know, because we see it's a place where we can have a true melting pot. You know, we really do have diverse voices. It's really people who believe that, hey, I might not agree with everything, but I want to hear it anyway. I want to hear, you know, what's out there. I want to hear things that I would have never have come across, you know, just watching mainstream news, not to mention all the subscriptions out there. Everything, it seems like every channel has its own $10 a month. You know, that's not going to hear independent news. That's not going to support the communities that we support. So please, kpfk.org, you can go and you can pick out a little thank you gift. It's, you know, just a little something to say thank you from the station, or 818-985-5735. And with that, I think we are out of time. That's why I'm talking faster now.
Right. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you to all of our guests, including General Manager Michael Novak, also attorneys Frank Campbell, Tatiana Barassa, and Helen Yu, and of course, our board op, D'Angelo Jones, and my co-host, Jim Lafferty, who will be back later. All right. Well, for this time, this is the Lawyers Guild Show.
Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. fight. Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's a cord that
support comes from Art Don't Sleep and Jazz Is Dead, presenting the nine-piece jazz funk collective Ghost Note on June.